Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Jill Marzeller. Ma'am, you may begin.
Okay, thank you. Hi, everybody. Welcome to our call. We're going to talk about auditing your care. This should be an exciting call, I think, because while we're really talking about the same principles that we discussed a few months ago, we're going to actually look at the audit forms this time, and you'll get a chance to kind of look through what's in them and think about them and so on. So I think this is going to be really good and make it much more tangible for you. So our learning objectives are that you'll be able to, by the end of our talk today, explain why measuring process is critical to success in this endeavor, and you'll be able to describe process measures that are planned for collection, as well as detail the planned collection process. On slide three, you see our good friend, the Donabedian model. If you think back to your Donabedian from 1966, you will remember that essentially he categorized variables in three areas: first structure, then process, and then outcome. And so structure includes how we organize care. So it's essentially a catalog of things like how many beds are there in your hospital, the presence of policies or specific committees towards quality improvement, and other things. Then process variables included what we do during care delivery, so how often, for example, are evidence-based interventions performed. And then the outcomes category includes the results that we achieve, so how many patients are accidentally harmed, for example. And so this is essentially the notion of how quality is produced. Structure influences process, which influences outcome. In the way that this series of categorizations is normally put in order to suggest that we can't just look at process, we can't just look at structure, and we can't just look at outcome. In order to really understand what we're doing, we need to try to consider all three. If, for example, you only had measures of structure and outcome, then people would say to you, especially in our design, which is not randomized, and does not have an explicit comparison group except for some of the STS measures, people would say, well, how do we know that they were actually doing what you said they were going to do, right? And so it's important to measure process not only for eventual reporting, but more importantly, because that's how you know whether things are working or not. That's how you know whether or not you are actually achieving your goal in the interim before you've got your final outcome measures. In addition to that, it's how you know where the problems are. So if you're measuring several aspects of process, that can often help you identify that the entire process is breaking down at a given point and that that's where you need to focus your energy. On slide four, there are a lot of different ways that you can approach the idea of measuring process. For example, one of the ones that we use in this project is our measures of perception, and we measure those on the team checkup tool. These have the advantage of the fact that they're pretty accessible, right? It's not hard to ask someone to tell you what their overall perception is of the extent to which our evidence-based practices are in use on the unit. So these are accessible. They're not too difficult to collect as long as people go into the database and enter the data. One issue, of course, is that there is a certain level of bias associated with perception measures. People who are participating in a quality improvement intervention like this one want to think that things are getting better over time. And so there is a certain level of expectation that things will be getting better, a certain, you know, set of rose-colored glasses that we might be wearing. So there may be some bias associated with these self-reported measures. Another approach to measuring process is using, you know, a process measure collection. So by this, I mean that you are perhaps on a daily basis keeping track of the number of ventilator patients that have their head of the bed elevated to the proper angle. So these kinds of process measures collection are certainly more objective, and, you know, that makes sense. It's a yes or no, and there hopefully is no fudging on that one, right? You're not going to try to say, well, it was sort of elevated, it was kind of, it was relatively close to what we were shooting for. You're not going to have to worry about that. It'll be a yes or a no. And so in that sense, it's more objective. But it's it also can be quite burdensome because these have to be, you know, kept on a daily basis, recorded. Somebody's got to put all that effort in to keep track of all of that. So another approach is somewhat less frequent than daily, let's say, auditing. And the notion of this is that you watch the process as it unfolds as an impartial observer, or you go around and collect the same kind of process data as I just described, for example, a survey of all beds, and you decide all eligible beds, and you just mark down how many of them met whichever criterion you're assessing. So this kind of auditing is less burdensome than trying to keep track of these things every day, quite possibly, and on the other hand, it could potentially be less reliable as well, because one of the issues with it is that you might walk in on a given day, and you might think, wow, everything looks fabulous today. But maybe that was a lucky day. And on another day, maybe it wouldn't have all looked quite so fabulous. So the fact that you're kind of sampling for an auditing strategy, as we put it forward here, makes it somewhat less reliable than if you were collecting something on a daily basis. So you can see that each one of the approaches to measuring process has some strengths and some weaknesses. And that's part of the reason why we're trying to do a little bit of each of them in this project, in order to be sure that we're doing a good job learning about our own processes as this project unfolds. So some of the process measures that you already collect are the skip measures, so antibiotic selection and timing, and whether the antibiotics are stopped within 48 hours, glucose measures, hair removal, and how that's done are all things that you're probably already collecting for the STS reporting. And then for this project, we're going to add some new measures, or new process measures or new audit topics. And these include, for example, although they haven't been officially decided upon, for the ventilator-acquired pneumonia portion of the project, we might be looking at head-of-the-bed elevation or sedation vacation, for example. For CLABSI, we're going to audit insertion for OR and ICU and maintenance for ICU floor and universal bed units. For SSI, we're going to look at skin prep, including type and appropriateness, antibiotics redosing. And we decided against a specific audit tool for environment, but rather took the approach that we would ask a question about the environment on the measure of self-perception, which is the team checkup tool. And then for the CUSP portion of our program, which of course is our cultural intervention, which is intended to improve overall safety, teamwork, and communication on the units, we will be auditing the use of the daily goals form, the morning briefing, and the learning from a defect tool in the ICU floor universal bed areas. And then in the OR, we'll be looking at the use of the briefing and debriefing, the use of the huddle, and then the learning from a defect tool in the OR setting. So how will we do this? Well, if you recall, the notion is that the audit data will not be collected every single day of every month. And we had set out a timeline for you, which I didn't repeat in this presentation, because the timeline has shifted somewhat since we have pushed back the SSI start date, because a lot of our sites are still working to get their IRBs approved and various other early steps of the project that need to get accomplished. So to accommodate that, we've pushed our start date back a little bit on the SSI measures, and that means that a lot of our audit plans are also pushed back a bit. So we'll be releasing an updated timeline, and I didn't want to give you an old timeline and have everyone be confused. But if you recall, the way that we had it set up was that, for example, for the cusp audits, you would do a cusp audit once every 3 months. For example, for the SSI measures, you would audit for the first 3 months, and then you would drop to a quarterly basis for auditing your SSI process. And the same thing would happen for VAP, with sort of a three-month intensive audit period and then dropping to a quarterly basis for that. So you will get reminder emails that will tell you what you're supposed to be auditing in this coming month. And you would do this by collecting data on a sort of once-a-week basis. And then you would report at the end of the month. In addition, the different kinds of methods for these things include some of them are tools where you're doing an observation. So you are trying to sort of unobtrusively observe as, for example, a line is placed. And you're making notes about how that's done. Some of the audit tools are counts have achieved whatever it is that you're looking for example, the count of all who were eligible to receive that. So daily goals is an example of that. And I'll talk about that more in a minute. And then others of the audit tools are sort of answering a series of questions. And I'll show you an example of that as well. So what you would do is keep track of it on paper forms. And the paper forms that we have made for you actually have a place for you to record 10 different observations or 10 days of counting various measures. If you want to do more than that, that's completely fine. You can do more than that. We've given you a generic form that you can add on as many observations as you wish to. And then there is a sort of summary grid on each one of the audit forms. And you would go through and count for all the observations you did and answer the questions in the summary grid. Then the summary grid data is essentially what you actually enter into the website reporting tool, and then it will give you some useful statistics back as a report. And so that should be helpful for you so that you don't have to calculate all that stuff yourself. So, for example, in antibiotics redosing, you put in the time of each dose. You don't have to calculate yourself whether or not, you know, how close was it, you know, was it exactly 4 hours? Was it not exactly 4 hours between dosing? You don't have to calculate that. You just put in the numbers, and then the website is going to generate that for you. It will figure that out for you and then tell you the percent of the time that the proper length of time was observed between doses. Okay. And when you go into the web tool, it's going to have information for you that tells you which audit data is due this month. So it'll be a reminder for you what you're supposed to be working on. And, you know, you'll know, oh, okay, this month I'm supposed to be entering my data for the cusp tool daily goals, not for something else that I wasn't prepared for. So that'll be good. And their web-based data entry forms. So let's go ahead and take a look at some of these forms. There was an email with bugobs of forms attached to it. That we sent you. Now, I don't want you to see these forms that are attached and freak out because, wow, there are a lot of forms there, right? Try not to think of it that way. Rather, remember that we've tried to pace it and break it out over a time period so that you're not actually auditing more than one thing at a time, usually. So if you are auditing your SSI measures during that first intensive period of time, you will not be auditing your VAP measures at the same time. Okay? And then when the cusp audits come on board, they will be just for 1 month at a time on a quarterly basis. And, you know, they may overlap with some of your other data collections, but they, you know, shouldn't overlap too much. They would only overlap with an audit that you've already done before. So it's not as though you have to learn, you know, two new things at the same time, for example. So let's get started, I think, by opening the one that's called Daily Goals. And when you open the Daily Goals tool, you will see that the way it's structured, as I was explaining to you before, is that it essentially says Daily Goals on it, and that it offers you a space for you to write in there what your month is, which month am I doing this audit. It gives you some brief instructions. Okay, and for this one, it's saying in the afternoon at the same time, 2 to 3 times a week, one member of the team should count all the patients who are on the unit, and they should check to see how many of those patients were visited as part of interdisciplinary rounds and how many of them actually had a daily goal sheet completed for them. Okay, so our notion is that this daily goal sheet would be done for everybody on an ICU or in the on the floor, and so that's what you're shooting for is 100% on this measure. So your observation one then would be how many patients were on the unit when I counted on this day, number of patients visited for interdisciplinary rounds today, number of patients with a daily goal sheet completed today, and number of patients for whom the daily goal sheet was visible, easily available when you did your audit. Okay. A lot less useful if people can't find that tool, and they won't be able to use it in structuring the care that they're giving. So that's observation one. It's simply repeated several times so that you can get at least 10. You fill at least 10. And then at the bottom of those 10, you will see on the page after, it's page 3 of 4, reporting instructions. So here you tally the information across the number of observations you completed this month. So again, that could be 10. If you decided to do more than 10, it will be more than 10. That's fine. Okay? And so you say you first put in your month and year. Then you say how many observations you conducted this month. What is the sum of all answers for question 1 above? What is the sum of all your answers for question 2, 3, and 4? And then that's the data that you then enter into the web-based data reporting system. Okay? And the final page of this packet, you see, is just a blank for you to use if you want to do more observations than 10. Now, with regard to that, if you are a large unit, you might want to consider doing more than 10. You know, we try to use the number 10 because we do have some variation in terms of the number or the sizes of the units that are participating, and so we wanted to find something that we felt was a fairly stable number of observations, and yet we did not want it to be too large for fear that it wouldn't apply to everybody. So that's what we're going for there. So let's now close that file and take a look at, instead, the audit learning from a defect. So everybody open that one. And as you open it, you'll see at the top it says learning from a defect. It again asks you for what month this is on your sheet. Keep these things separate so that you can keep track of what you're doing. The instructions are simple. In a meeting with all your CUSP team members and your executive partner, review the following questions. So in this case, this is about whether you conducted a learning from a defect, or how much you're using that process. This is one of those processes within CUSP that we think is just invaluable in terms of not only identifying potential problems before they ever reach the patient, perhaps. Okay, that's worth its weight in gold to prevent a problem from ever reaching someone. And it's also a critical piece of helping people to feel empowered to make changes within the care and within the environment that they work in, okay? This is also worth its weight in gold in the sense that the more a person feels that when they make an observation that something is not right, something then is done to fix it or to at least attempt to fix it. That's really important for the people who work there. It makes people feel that they're very involved, that they have the power to make a difference in terms of the environment that you're in, and can really create those early wins that you learn about in terms of managing change that allows everybody to see, wow, you know what, we're not doing things exactly the same old way anymore. This is a new era. We're in there, we're really fixing things, we're really making things safer, we're really working better with our colleagues to provide the best care and also to have a really rewarding environment for the people who work here. So learning from a defect to audit this process, though, you know, the issue here is to audit a process, you have to have a time when you can go look at it, right? Or you need to be able to count something, right? And you can't really do either one of those very well with respect to learning from a defect because it's kind of an ongoing process of selecting something, working on something, having meetings, asking questions about the particular potential problem, and so on. And so the way we structured this instead was as a series of questions. So you write the date, and then the first question is, over the last 6 months, how many defects were, first of all, identified? And they could have been identified from many different sources, some of which are listed there for you. The next question is, how many defects were shared with all CUSP teams for OR, ICU, and floor for review? Okay, so how many of these defects did you sort of talk across all your CUSP teams about? How many defects then were prioritized to actually be investigated further? Investigated, okay? So you may have prioritized something and then nobody ever got around to actually looking into it. Or perhaps you did a good investigation, but there was no actual solution developed. So you can see how that would be a process interrupted and therefore a process ineffectual because it didn't reach its natural conclusion. Then, of course, we really encourage you to evaluate whether or not the solution that you undertook was successful. And we further encourage you to publicize, to the extent you can, either in your clinical area or on your unit, what was done, what was the problem identified, what was the nature of the problem, what were the contributors to the problem, and then what was the proposed solution, and how did we do in terms of actually resolving that particular issue. Then we'd like you to tell us if your executive partner was involved in the process of trying to address that defect. Did all relevant member groups participate in the process? So, you know, depending on what the nature of the defect was, did you just stick with the people on the unit or did you go outside the unit to try to fix this? If, for example, you had a specific problem, you know, did you include housekeeping? Did you, you know, did you ask anybody in QA what they thought about it and so on? Furthermore, you know, it's sometimes possible that, you know, there's a small group and the small group decides to fix something and they decide to fix it within nursing, for example. And so if they never go to any of the other disciplines and ask what they think about the issue or what contributors they see to a particular issue, you know, then you're getting an incomplete picture, A, of the problem in the first place, but then, B, probably an incomplete solution as well. And certainly we've seen things over the years where, you know, if there's a medication error, then, you know, maybe nursing decides, okay, well, we can fix that. We'll just do a backup check. You know, somebody else will review what the first person did, and that'll be fine. And so they kind of try to take care of the problem themselves without involving anybody else. But that's not usually the most conclusive way to deal with the problem. And so we try to really include everybody that might have a perspective on the issue. And then finally, after addressing a defect that was prioritized, did you look at further issues to work on? So you finished one defect. Did you just leave it there, or did you go back and say, what else could we start working on? That's what that question is about. And then as you proceed down the page, you can see that the reporting instructions are simply to enter the information from this table directly into the CSTS web-based data reporting system. And then we've provided you with the key to a couple of those acronyms included on that page. Okay, so we've looked at two of the different types of audit tools. Let's go ahead and open the OR briefing audit tool and take a look at this one. Now, this one is structured a little bit differently. It is one that requires observation of the process as it unfolds, the process of doing an OR briefing. So when you open this tool, you'll see that the instructions say that someone who is not involved in the case should join the OR before the case is scheduled to start. And then the hope is that you will try to attend at least 10 cases within a given month. And the observer should try to stay quiet, try not to draw a lot of attention to yourself. And because you're somebody who already works there, the chances are good that you won't call all that much attention. Probably the first time you go in there, people might notice a bit. Normally, people tend to forget that the observer is there because they're moving on with their own process and the things that they have to do. Then you will mark answers to the following questions for each of the briefings that you observe. Okay? So the observer does not have to be the same person every time. If we were doing this, you know, in the purest way, then you would have the same observer always. But we don't think that that's very feasible, so we're not requiring that. But what you should do is get your observers all together beforehand and talk about what would be a good way to do these observations in order to try to make them as uniform as possible. So you discuss the questions. You talk about how each person interprets the question, how they would mark yes, no, or yes after reminder, so that you're consistent across your observers. So, again, we have 10 observations, little blocks for you to fill in 10 observations. The first question is, a briefing was completed. So at the time that the briefing was supposed to be done, was it done? Yes, no, or yes after reminder. So the purpose there is that because we're trying to improve this process, you may find yourself in the position of saying, gosh, guys, did we forget to do our briefing? And that's okay for you to do that. You'll just mark yes, I reminded everybody, and yes, they went ahead and did the briefing. This is kind of a growing process, and at some point you may decide that in your site you don't want to remind people, and you'll just count that as a no. But if you wish to offer reminders, your team should decide, yes, after reminder, it was done. Okay? And the second question is, briefing process occurred before the patient entered the OR. So is that true or is that not true? Now, we have heard of some places that try to do the briefing with the patient in the room. If that's something that you're trying to do for some specific reason, then you should sort of let us know that that's a particular goal of yours, because we will be trying to tally some of this data across sites so that we can see how everybody is doing. In general, we think it's best if the briefing process occurs before the patient enters the OR. All team members were present for the briefing, and this includes the attending physician. So you don't want to be in a situation where the team's going ahead and they're doing the briefing, but some of the key people are not actually there, including perhaps the surgeon. That's not so great. Everyone in the room introduced themselves and stated their role in the procedure, something that we're looking for. The anesthesia provider and the attending surgeon discussed the estimated blood loss and the blood availability in case the need arises. All right. And then the next question, circulating nurse ensured all equipment needed for the procedure was in the OR. And finally, efforts were made to minimize distractions during the briefing. Okay? So those of you who know a lot about briefings, and I'm sure that many of you do, this doesn't hit absolutely every element of the perfect briefing. We are trying to keep these audits short and manageable. We are trying to hit some of the key elements that are, we think, very important to the effectiveness of briefings. And so that's the goal for these audit tools, is to keep them short, keep them manageable, not have too many questions in order to keep them doable as observations. When we move to page 3 of 5, you can see here the reporting instructions. And so just once again, there is a table for you to use to tally the information across all of the observations that were completed that month. And so you simply go through and tell them how many observations and then how many yes answers were there for each of the questions in the above tools. And that's what you would enter again, into the web-based reporting system. So I think you've got an idea essentially of how these audit sheets have been set up. There's just one more that I think we might go through, or let me at least mention to you, and that is that there are kind of two different audit tools that are both about about maintenance, right? Central line maintenance. So first there's a central line insertion audit tool, and that's for observing line insertions. Then there is a central line maintenance tool that, again, is for observing the way that dressings are changed. Then there is another one that we have added called the daily central line audit and infection control report. So if you open that one, this one looks a lot more. In fact, I think it looks very much like one that was sent to us by one of the teams. The reason that we don't put them together, okay, when you're observing maintenance, that's done, the maintenance is done at one time period, okay. Whereas these aspects of auditing your central line, some of the aspects of your central line could be done at a different time, okay? So somebody might be checking to see if the clave is of the correct color and is the dressing dated, but that doesn't have to happen during a dressing change and, in fact, probably doesn't happen during a dressing change. They're probably not doing both things at the same time, and for that reason, we wanted to provide a separate tool that would allow you to assess some of these other things on a different time frame than the actual dressing change time frame. So that's what's going on with that one. And we thank very much the sites that sent us examples of the kind of audit tools that they already use. They were very helpful to us in terms of informing our thinking about how to create these audit tools and what was important to try to get on the audit tools. So I'm going to wrap up now with our final slide from the PowerPoint and just try to reiterate to you that process measurement should really be something that you want to do because it's going to help you. As you work on your project, you need to know what's working and what is not working. So we know that compliance is one of the main, you know, fundamental aspects of providing evidence-based practice. If it's only happening half the time, then That's half of the time that you're missing that opportunity to provide the evidence-based practice. And so we know that it's the evidence-based practices that allow you to meet your outcomes goals. So collecting these process measures is going to give you a map as to what you're doing well, what you're not doing well, what you need to really concentrate on in order to get everything into compliance. And so it also allows you to provide your people with regular feedback on their performance. If people don't know that they're not doing it consistently, then they will all assume that they're doing a great job. And so it's important to be able to get their buy-in by saying, no, you know what, we're only 90% or maybe we're only 75% compliant on a given expectation or evidence-based practice. And so it's really important to have that transparency so that people realize that. It can be very motivating to them to realize that it's not perfect at this point. And it also helps you as the person running the project to know where are the places where we're not quite meeting our goals. So you can use these data to inform and motivate, and you can also use it to communicate laterally with people on your unit, but as well to communicate upward and let them know how you're doing on your project. Give them some interim data so they don't have to wait till the end to see whether it worked or not. They can see, you know, at some interim period, you know, how things are going, and they can watch you improve over time, which can be great. So I appreciate your time and the fact that you sat there and listened to me talk all this time. I'm not going to go through every form. The rest of the forms are attached there for you to look through at your convenience. But I think this is a good time for us to open the lines and see whether anybody has any questions. And let me also comment that we have Kathleen Spack on the line and Vicki Chang as well from our project. So if you have questions for either one of them, they're also here and available. And anyone else who's available from the CSTS team, you know, should please also identify yourselves in case folks have questions for you. So, operator, if we could see whether there are any questions at this time.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. You will be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your question, you may press star 2. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment for the first question, please. Our first question comes from Linda Formby.
Hi, Linda.
Hi there. Thank you so much for the audit tools and for all the hard work that you put into developing those. We really do appreciate it, and I'm sure they will be very helpful. I did have a couple of comments. Can we add hand hygiene to the central line insertion audit tool?
Let me just take a look here at what we have in that one. If I could open it up. Insertion, you said.
Yes.
Okay, let's just take a look. Am I opening the wrong one? Okay. Okay, so we didn't specifically ask about the hand hygiene. And how would you phrase a question about that in particular? Are you interested in how in the amount of time spent washing, or merely did you see them wash before the insertion?
Well, we have our central line insertion audit tool phrased, which I don't have it open in front of me, but I believe it simply asks, was hand hygiene performed prior to insertion?
Okay. All right.
It seems like that would be done, but sometimes it may not be.
yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it's interesting because I think we were trying to go, again, I mean, I know I said this already, but we were trying to go for the smallest number of questions that we thought we could do. But it's funny because I think we all realize that the hand hygiene can be inconsistent. despite everyone's appreciation of how important that is.
My thought is that that is a question we can't leave out.
Right. Okay.
And I wanted to comment, too, on the central line care audit tool, which differs a bit from the one that we currently use. Could we make changes to that that would not change the content? For instance, we use ChloraScrub to prep our ports for access. So we would need to change the wording from alcohol to ChloraScrub.
Okay. So let's see. I'm sorry. Which tool are you? Can I join?
I'm sorry. Central Line Care.
Central Line.
So, Jill, I think we're talking about number 3.
Central Line Maintenance. I'm sorry.
Was the needleless connector scrub for 30 seconds with 70% alcohol. And, you know, the literature doesn't support how long to do it, really. But what it does support is the use of 70% isopropyl or chlorhexidine or ChloraScrub.
Yeah, so we realized that when we made the product change, but we do use ChloraScrub, and we've had some further decreases in our CLABSI rate as a result of that.
Yeah, so I think that we could definitely add 70% alcohol or ChloraScrub before access.
Right, and I agree with you about scrubbing for 30 seconds. We don't have a time for scrubbing. We actually have a time for drying.
Right, and that varies too. The last thing that I saw, and there's not been a big study, you know, that they say treat the clave or the hub like you're juicing an orange and go around completely
right.
10 times at least for 30 seconds was the last thing I saw, but there's not been a big study to tell us exactly how long.
Exactly. And I don't remember now that you mentioned the clave, there is a reference to claves. We don't use claves. We don't use different colored claves. I can't remember now where I saw it.
It was in the one that was the daily audit.
Yes, and we're not collecting that one. That's for your use. So
okay.
You can make any changes that you want to that because we know
okay.
that some sites don't use we encourage, if you do use claves, you know, neutral pressure rather than positive pressures. But other than that, we're not collecting that information.
So I assume that the use of the daily central line audit and infection control report is to encourage, it could be utilized to encourage getting the line out because you're asking the question, reason for central line. So if that reason no longer exists, then perhaps you need to remove that. I like this tool, so I appreciate you sharing that with us.
Sure.
Okay, well, thank you so much for those comments. That really that helps us to make it more applicable.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Jerry Huber.
Hi, I was wondering, on the daily goals, you know, I know that you have outlined some forms in that, but within the electronic record, we actually have posted our daily goals in our critical care population. Is it okay if we use that, or do we have to use some of the suggested actual forms themselves?
This is David, and no. In fact, every tool that we send out, we encourage you to adapt it to meet your own. So in other studies, other collaboratives we've done, people have taken our paper copies and made them electronic forms. If you have something that's very similar that works for you, you can continue to use it, but just treat it when you're doing the audit. You can just treat your form, your electronic form, like the paper form, so that when you do this audit, you're actually auditing to make sure. And if you do it every day, then, you know, we're going to see 100% compliance coming from your unit. That's the beauty of all of the quality improvement tools. Any of them can be adapted to meet local needs. And so when we say a tool is finished, it doesn't mean finished. It's finished with us, but you can make any changes that you want. So if you have something that works well for you and essentially has the same elements, that's absolutely fine with us.
One of the other...
This is Jill. I was just going to comment that I think it is helpful for you to look at the tool that we put out there, and I think there's more than one example of a daily goals sheet available as well. you know, in order to see whether some of the things that other places thought were important, maybe you'd say to yourself, oh, gosh, you know, we didn't include that, but maybe we should, just for the purposes of you know, potentially improving your own tool that you already like. And then, you know, really trying to make sure that the purpose is still met, which is the notion of getting everybody on the same page with concrete goals to achieve for that particular day, instead of these kind of vague statements about, well, we'll diarese today, but then there's no, you know, there's no parameters set on what that means or when you should call the doctor and when you shouldn't, that sort of thing. So that's kind of what we're shooting for with that, and if you feel that your tool is doing that, then that's terrific. Yeah.
Then the other thing is that we are fortunate in that we also have our ICU monitored by the electronic ICU, and they are already auditing daily some of the exact same things that you have here, especially for CLEPSI and for VAP. So my question is it all right if I discuss this with their director, if they collect the data since they camera in on mm-hmm. these rooms every day?
I think that if you're comfortable with that, it would be okay, as long as we feel like they're getting an accurate picture when they camera in. And some of the items, if it's the same kind of data, if it's the same items collected, would they give you they would give you the full data set on what they've observed?
Yes. And in mm-hmm. fact, we actually called them when we're starting to insert a line, so that they go through the checklist to make sure that we are indeed, you know, following the bundle.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, yeah.
I'm just thinking that I do not want to duplicate efforts that are out there,
right,
and that have already, you know, worked. And we, you know, want to make sure that it is a consistent process and something that could be carried on to the other ICUs if necessary. And since we've already got something in place, I just, you know, I think the ideas are great. I think that some of the forums are wonderful, but I also know that there's more than one way to get the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's fine. Are you going to be able to report that into the web-based system somehow?
Sure.
Okay. Yep.
Can I ask a question? When they monitor central line insertion, do they stop it?
If yep. Not?
Okay.
Sounds great.
Yep.
Okay,
our next question.
That all sounds good. Do we have other questions?
Yes, our next question comes from Joyce Warr.
Hi, Joyce.
Hey, Jill and David. And forgive me if I missed it. David and I were actually talking briefly on another line. The central line insertion audit, is there an intent to monitor 10 OR central line insertions and 10 ICU? Because I know in the lens study, and just my own personal experience, the central line insertion in the operating room may be the worse than the ICU.
I do think that we envisioned that it would be done in the OR and the ICU separately and reported for each of those areas.
Yes, that's right. It's the same if a patient starts to deteriorate on an inpatient floor or a floor that has a lot of PICC lines, so you would still be doing a checklist for them as well. We did really not think that might happen very often, but we were counting on an audit in the intensive care unit and in the OR. And we also were talking with the hospital epidemiologist, even though it doesn't meet the CDC definitions, that they would be able to then apprise the area that placed the line whether or not the infection occurred within 48 to 72 hours, if there was one, so that even though the infection would be attributed to the ICU, they would be able to say that it was from a line placed in the OR. So it would be very helpful to have both of those done.
Yeah, I think that's just so important because I see people get really careless, you know, in the operating room, time pressures, and they start putting in Foley's. So I think getting that feedback on how they're doing in the OR would be tremendously helpful.
Yep, that sounds good.
Our next question comes from Rita Smith.
Hi, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, sure can.
Oh, great. I had a question about the audit in the OR briefing. And the question is, number five, it talks about the anesthesia provider and the attending surgeon discuss the estimated blood loss and blood availability in case the need arises. So at the beginning of the case, you would probably discuss blood availability in case there was a need. But to be able to have an observer in the room for the entire case, to wait to the very end to actually talk about what the EBL was, I'm just not thinking this is going to be feasible to have one person be able to stay for the entire open heart cases. And so would it be acceptable if we choose one or the other, or if you wanted both of those answers, then I would want to choose someone else that I could rely upon to tell me if they did discuss the EBL. Do you understand my question?
Yeah, I think I understand your question.
Okay.
Let me say that our anticipation was that this piece would be done up front, and then there's a separate audit tool for the debriefing. And it, I think here we were envisioning, you know, their projection.
Right, okay, right. And that makes sense to do at the beginning of the case, how much blood is available in case we need it, as opposed to discussing what the EBL was. So I was a little confused by that part.
Okay.
So that really should be left for the debriefing.
So right. I think maybe our phraseology is what was the problem. It does mean
okay.
sort of projection of what blood loss might be and blood availability.
Great. Okie doke, that helps me out.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Rita, I think we'll take out that. The anesthesiologists that we work with say that there's a projected amount, but
yeah.
I think without saying that, I think we could take that away and just leave the blood availability, and
oh.
that would be easier.
That would be really great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question comes from Kit Young.
Hi there. Can you talk a little bit more about where and when the observers are going to be assigned to do the audits? Because I'm particularly thinking about the fact that everybody in our OR pool is going to be, everybody who's present is going to be working during that time, and everybody who's outside of the OR pool is either not working when we get started in the morning when the AM huddle would occur at, say, 6 a.m., or at the beginning of the procedure doing the briefing at 7 a.m., you know, all the administrative people who might be observers are not going to be there. The floor nurses, everybody has their own clinical responsibilities. So where do we get the observers from?
Well, I guess we anticipated that there would be someone that was available as a backup person or waiting, you know, who was coming on early in order to prepare for later cases who might be available. I think that the qualifications for an observer, if they're kind of trained on, you know, these specific items, to look for these specific items, don't necessarily need to be, you know, very great.
About the only person who's there who's not working on other projects at that time would be a housekeeper.
Or an equipment technician, perhaps. David or Kathleen, do either one of you have ideas, or do other people on the call have ideas about this problem?
So, you know, with the ICU, it's generally done by, you know, the different clinicians. So it might be the nurse educator, the nurse manager, or a nurse that does this randomly. I think that in the OR it is a little bit different, and you can have, you know, at different times, the circulating nurse might be able to audit the central line insertion. There is no central line dressing, so that's off the table. We also thought that maybe if you had an anesthesiology tech that they could potentially audit the breathing. As Jill said, you don't do this every day of the study. It's just for different time points within the study. And to work, you know,
when you're actually auditing it, you're asking us to do about one in every 2 to 3 days audit, and all the people who are present who might be, like, say, an anesthesia tech or something like that, we have 2 or 3 cases starting at once, so they're just not available. I've been thinking about this for the past hour, trying to come up with someone, anyone, who might be available to jump around and be ready at the time of the briefing, and I can't come up with anybody.
Yeah, I think for people that aren't in a teaching hospital, they have additional issues with this that, you know, we have more bodies in a teaching hospital, and so you are in a unique situation, and, you know, I'd be interested to hear what other people thought, because we thought the anesthesiology tech, we thought the circulating nurse, we thought if the scrub nurse was set up, he or she might be able to do some of this, but it would certainly not be somebody that could be assigned consistently the same person like we do in the ICU.
The problem with that is the standard for those briefings are that everybody in the room is considered, at least at our institution, is considered a vital part of the procedure and is not supposed to be doing anything else during the briefing and time out. So they're not available. Virtually nobody who is in the room with in a functional capacity should be considered available to be doing an audit.
Well, Kim, what about the idea of having your CUSP executive partner try to do some of these audits?
Well,
you know, you might not get them to show up for a 6 a.m. I'm not sure.
This
could be somebody who's dedicated to your area, to helping you out. Or potentially someone who works for that person who might be asked to come down and do some audits?
Right. They could do it, but we're not going to be doing as many audits anywhere near as many as you want, and we're going to be asking them to start one hour or 2 hours, if it's for the AM huddle, before they report to work.
How about if you, this is Kathleen, how about if you have somebody who participates, in the briefing actually fill this out? It can act as cues to make sure that everything's covered that needs to be covered, and it would take, you know, however many checks, 7 checks at the most, to fill this thing out. It, like I said, you can use it as a set of cues to make sure that the relevant things are covered. Would that work?
Someone who's taking part in the briefing is going to be biased. It's going to automatically introduce bias into the process.
That's true.
They're not going to be a disinterested bystander observer, and the value of them filling out an audit is similar to, I mean, we had a similar 2 or 3 years ago when we had a checklist for a CLABSI checklist instituted. We had the nurses observing us, but the nurses were, it was within their best interest to not find anything wrong with the process, because then they had to do further documentation, et cetera, et cetera, and the process worked against itself. And you're going to have the same issue as that with anybody who is part of the process.
That's absolutely true. I was just trying to find a way that you could get the briefing done and still get some kind of feedback, whether biased or not. It would be a consistent bias at the very least.
Is a consistent bias better than is it better to have, say, an executive or an administrator come down once or twice a month to check it, and also to be known that they're there watching and thereby getting biased that way better, or is it better to have a consistent bias from someone who is not a disinterested party?
I don't know. What do you think, Jill?
Yeah, that's kind of a tough one. I mean, I think that the issue a little bit is whether you think you can get somebody to try to separate themselves from it in the sense that they're trying to be objective when they fill out the form. I mean, I think it would be better to have more observations as opposed to having somebody who can only do maybe two or three, because the mere fact that they are kind of a leader and they're suddenly showing up in the OR, I mean, could really affect, you know, behavior in a pretty strong way, or people would at least be like, well, what's he doing here, you know, or she.
Right.
So I guess I think it would probably be better to get a larger number of observations and then, you know, run a bit of the risk of having somebody involved in the procedure doing it. I think that's a lower or a lesser risk, especially if, you know, it's somebody on the cusp team, it's somebody who's trying, whose main concern is, are we really doing this right, you know, who might even, if anything, be a little tougher on the team than they would be if they weren't on the cusp team. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The difficulty is that the cusp team members who are going to be involved are the anesthesiologist, the surgeon, the primary circulating nurse, all of which who really can't be not taking part in the briefing and doing the direct observation.
Right. Well, I mean, I think you're just going to have to talk to the person that is able to do the observation, or, you know, possibly have them do it immediately following the briefing rather than during the briefing, in order to make sure that they're not missing something that they're supposed to be doing within the briefing. And you know, just say, look, this is what we're trying to get at. We really want you to be honest on this. We want you to be tough on us, and that kind of thing. Because, I mean, I agree with you. The purpose of all of this is to be truthful and learn what you need to learn, this is across all of your different people. You know, you're going to try to make sure that you're not always observing the exact same surgeon, for example, or the exact same, you know, set of people. And try to collect a little bit of information about how it's going overall. It's meant to be your eyes in the field, where you can't be all the time. Your cusp team can't be all the time. So, you know, I mean, I appreciate all of these points that you've brought up. I think that it highlights the imperfection of this process, but I do think we could still learn something valuable from undertaking it.
I agree. It's going to be a sporadic observation at our institution. It's not going to be a regular one.
Okay. Well, the notion was that we were going to try to do these, the briefing, the way that the briefing observation and debriefing observations are set up is that they happen in 1 month, and then you would switch to looking at something else a quarter later. But you will look at briefings at least twice during the period of the study. Does that make sense? So that we hopefully will be able to see that, you know, at our first set of briefings, this is how we were doing, and at our later set of briefings, this is how we were doing. And so for you, that's got information, assuming that your process has the same, you know, issues in both time periods, you should still be able to get a read on whether it's getting any better. We hope.
We'll just have to see how it works. Like I say, I'm still struggling with even trying to come up with a biased observer who's going to be readily trained to be an to do the observation.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know, let's keep talking about it and see if we can come up with any other ideas. But I appreciate your giving us serious thought and looking for the way to make it work.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Richard Engelman.
Hi, this is a quickie, I hope. Just have you people done a survey of the hospitals to determine whether in the OR brief that it occurs primarily before the patients enter the OR or after in most of our institutions? I know in ours it is after they enter the operating room, but before the operation starts.
So no, I think the answer to that is no. I don't think we've surveyed across all of them as to how it's done. David, can you comment on the reasoning behind having it done before the patient arrives? Is it just because everything gets too busy once the patient's there?
There are different perspectives, and what we saw during the lens study or the lens observations were that most sites weren't doing briefings. We did see briefings at two sites, and one actually invited the patient to walk in, introduce themselves, and tell us about themselves, and then they went on and did the briefing with the patient there, alert and oriented, and the other site did it the other way. And I think there, you know, are probably benefits to both. And but we did not survey to see whether or not which way each hospital did it. I don't know if that's something that you want to add to the briefing audit itself, whether or not it happened pre or post patient entering. And I'm not really sure. Dr. Engelman, what information do you think that would provide?
Well, I think in terms of the observation survey you have here, where all team members present for the briefing, which I think is an essential, it's more likely that that would be able to occur after the patient is actually present in the operating room because of all the issues relative to people having to do occupations relative to preparing for the operation and therefore not always available for the brief. But with the patient there, everybody should be there, and the brief could easily occur, and in our setting does occur at that point in time.
So let me comment that, you know, the question right now may appear to assume that it's better to not have the patient in there, okay, but technically it is just a yes or no question. So we could use it as a data collection device, if you will, without having necessarily any kind of judgment associated with it. Do you see what I'm saying? It merely says, was it done before the patient entered the OR? And so if...
Yeah, that would be an interesting survey, actually. You're right.
Right. So, you know, so if everybody says no, 80% of the time, no, you know, then that's something for us all to talk about as a group, but it's not per se a wrong answer. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
And we got a lot of this was feedback from focus groups after the tool development last summer, where we asked members from the SCA to participate, and the consensus was before. But like I said, when we were doing the lens study, we saw both. So I can't say that one was better than the other.
The other comment relative to the last issue that we were addressing is that it is possible, I would think, that since in most operating rooms there'll be afternoon cases, that whoever observes might not have to be there at 6:30 in the morning and might be able to come in around noon or 1 o'clock and observe the afternoon case.
Right, right. I mean, the one issue, you know, the small, we've already got too many issues with that one, but...
Yeah, right. That went on for a long time. Yeah,
and another issue would just be that it would be, you know, you wouldn't know what's going on in the morning, whether the morning is consistently different than the afternoon, because, you know, we're hoping that it'll end up being, you know, a smattering of different times
mm-hmm.
observations are collected.
Right.
Right, but we have to be respectful of the providers and not, you know, impact on them negatively, too, so...
And the comment that was made is that everybody is so occupied, and that's absolutely correct. And otherwise, yeah, you're going to get biased opinions. You're right.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Ann Greenberg.
Oh, hi. I just had a suggestion for the observer in the OR, and I don't know if Kit has any research nurses. We were thinking of maybe using some of ours to be observers because they're normally in the OR when studies are going on.
Mm-hmm. So how about that, Kit? Would that work for you? Perhaps? It sounds like we might have lost Kit.
Okay.
But
so
it is something that we can.
That.
Yeah, we can suggest that. And so, Jill, it's quarter past the hour. Last question.
Our last question comes from Nancy Kashar.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Anand Kashikar from Bay State Medical Center. Dr. Engelman stole my thunder. My question was about we follow the practice of getting doing the briefing after the patient is in the room. So he discussed that part. And the other question was about the observer. We have a research person who basically is available, but I think it would be very difficult, especially if our heart cases start 7:15 in the morning. That means briefing has to be done before 6:45. So that will be a little bit of problem to get them in early. Other suggestions from other people were, I think we have to seriously think about who would be an unbiased observer in this study.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think these are excellent points. I think I will request that we all give this some additional thought. And within your context, if you're able to think of a solution, then let us all know to try to figure out whether your solution can also be applied elsewhere.
We will think about it. I'll have a discussion with Dr. Engelman and come up with some solutions and pass on if there is any constructive suggestion from us.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening and joining in today's call. Certainly, this was a hot topic for discussion, engaging, and lots of good suggestions made. So if you have other suggestions, then you should feel free to send them to us via email. Again, appreciate your attention very much, and I hope everyone has a lovely rest of your day.
Same to you. Thank you.
Thank you.